essentially, like down in the bowling alley, past all these planets. Now, this is more, there's more to it than just visiting all these same planets with the same spacecraft. The planet Jupiter in particular has a very powerful gravitational field, and it turns out that when you approach Jupiter with a speed just about necessary to get to Jupiter in the first place, and you approach the planet from behind, in other words, at the trailing edge, then the fact that Jupiter is moving through its orbit gives the spacecraft another jerk. You are stealing some energy out of the gravitational field of Jupiter, and this is an equivalent of a very powerful chemical booster way out in the planetary world that will hurl your spacecraft out to other planets. Depending now on how you do it, you can either fly a spacecraft along the red line, going out to Jupiter, and using the Jupiter boost to drive it out to Saturn, and then do the same thing with Saturn once more and drive it all the way out to Pluto. Or you can approach Jupiter a little differently, maybe a few days earlier or later, a few months earlier and later, and have the thing, have Jupiter swing the thing around so that your probe goes to Uranus and on to Neptune. So the intriguing part of the grand tour is not that you have all planets lined up in a row and you can visit them, and it's kind of an interplanetary bowling contest, but the fact that you can use during this particular opportunity the boost of Jupiter to reach all of the outer planets. And that means that you can do with a much smaller rocket what otherwise would require tremendous power. In fact, a thing like the Titan IIIC using this trick would hurl about the same type of spacecraft to Pluto or Neptune that would take a vehicle the size of a Saturn V plus a Centaur stage on top of the S4B to do all this without Jupiter's help. That is why we are so excited about the Grand Tour. Next slide. Well, we are so far I talked about manned space flight and exploration, and here you see exploration once more. The purpose of the exercise is to study the sun and the planets. But the other side of our objectives is, of course, an Earth-related applications program. And here, the three most important features are communication satellites or objectives, communication satellites, and things spun out of them, such as navigation or combined navigation and aircraft communication satellites. And then secondly, the family of Earth resources satellites that deal with things like crop surveys and oceanographic work and surveys of forests and possibly even prospecting for minerals and oil. And finally, the category of the weather satellites, shown here, that will help build up a worldwide weather forecasting system that will enable us, hopefully, to reliably predict the weather as much as 2 weeks ahead. Next slide. Among the communications satellite programs, we distinguish between the following categories. One is the multiple access and data collection system. Let me put this in very simple language. Suppose Alexander Graham Bell had invented the telephone only yesterday, and he would know that we have the capability of putting satellites, in particular synchronous satellites, in orbit. He would probably have advocated not ever to string a telephone line further than beyond the city limits. And he would most certainly have advised against transcontinental cables, transcontinental coax lines, microwave links, and all this kind of stuff. that I understand costs about $12 billion a year, that year after year goes into these kind of things in the United States alone, three times the value of the space program. He would probably instead have put a great big, or maybe several smaller, switching stations in orbit with steerable antennas, or maybe controlled controlled beams with these phased arrays that would enable you to put a, say, a gigahertz beam down onto St. Louis and another one on Tampa. And if somebody wants to talk from St. Louis with another fellow in Tampa, he would just dial these two beams and talk like that. We can do that today. The technology is well understood, and it's simply a question of introducing such a system, which is undoubtedly a much more modern and straightforward and more economical way of establishing communication into the face of an existing but obsolescent system. You may have heard that very recently the FCC has finally seen fit to invite industry to bid on such satellites. And the problem here really is one of getting action in this field. Now, in countries that are not yet blessed with communication systems that are 20 or even 50 years old, but have never done this, they find themselves pretty much in the situation of a country that never built a railroad, and for that reason bypassed the railroad stage altogether and went directly to airplanes. It is for this reason that there's really quite some interest in other countries about the development of these possibilities, because it seems to enable them to provide telephone and also television connection to areas which otherwise would be completely inaccessible to them. So the multiple access and data collection system using this new technology has undoubtedly a tremendous market. Navigation and traffic control is another communication satellite thing. You can track a ship, or more importantly an airplane, from a satellite, tell the airplane where he is, and at the same time serve the plane crew, or conceivably even the passengers, with uninterrupted communications with land masses. For example, it's entirely conceivable with such a system to place telephone calls from an airliner over the Pacific or the Atlantic. The Atlantic traffic control situation, by the way, is far more serious than most people realize. It so happens that planes flying, say, from New York over to Europe all want to depart at 6 p.m. in order to serve dinner and movies, and they all want to go to the same optimum altitude where they make maximum use of favorable tailwinds. And as a result, there is really quite some traffic in a rather limited area. On the other hand, there are no omni stations in between on the wide open spaces of the Atlantic. And the problem of keeping this highly international traffic, by the way, sufficiently spaced, becomes more and more serious. So there is a great desire on the part of the airline to provide airliners crossing the North Atlantic with better navigation aid, and satellites can help a great deal here. Data release is another thing. For example, if you have weather satellites, one way, of course, of getting the information on the weather is that you wait until the thing overflies the United States, which may be hours later, and the information may be obsolete in the meantime. Or you have these weather satellites beam their information onto a higher flying, for example, synchronous satellite, which is in continuous line of sight contact with the United States, so that uninterrupted communication from a satellite, no matter where it is over the Earth, on real time with United States receiver stations will become available. Such data release can then, of course, also be used to monitor space flights to the moon and the planets. Another thing is broadcast TV. Now, this is an entirely different animal than this here. Broadcast TV means you put a satellite in orbit that is powerful enough to broadcast its message directly into cheap receiver sets on the ground. The first project like this, very typically, is not involved with any operations in the United States, but with India. The United States concluded in November, I think on the 16th or 18th of September of last year, you may want to look up the exact date, a treaty with India, with the Indian government, under which our ETS, Advanced Technology Satellite F, will be established over the Indian Ocean. It will be capable of radiating out of its 30-foot antenna about 80 watts of energy down onto India. The Indian government will establish a ground station in the city of Ahmedabad, which is about 50 miles north of Bombay. And there, television educational programs will be generated and sent up to the satellite in synchronous orbit. The satellite will radio it back on this beam onto the Indian subcontinent and relatively normal television sets, just with a special input end attached to a normal TV set, can fish this television program out of the sky and can be used for a public education program. The Indian government under this treaty plans to build or buy 5,000 community sets, which will be located in 5,000 Hindi-speaking villages in northern India. And these people will then be given the benefit of educational programs disseminated from Ahmedabad. Interesting angles of this treaty are the following. Number one, there's not a penny of money exchanged between the United States. All what we do here from NASA is we put that satellite in orbit on time. The Indian government builds its ground station and its 5,000 receiver sets. And by ordering these with the electronics industry in India, this is also a very effective way of giving their own electronic industry, the domestic electronic industry, a healthy shot in the arm. The United States will not participate at all in the planning of the software and the laying out of the programs that are actually being disseminated. The Indian government plans to use these receivers particularly for educational purposes in the morning, in other words, reading, writing, arithmetic from 8 to 12. And there will be also a couple of hours devoted to aid to the farmers in the form of advice, how to plant, how to fertilize, what seed good to select, etc. And I think there will also be an hour or so devoted to family planning. One of the more interesting aspects of this thing is that 90% of the villages in India that will have these receiver sets will not even have rural power, rural electricity. So along with that television set must go a little lawnmower engine with a generator to make the 500 watts or so power. And I think in many cases you can probably even expect a stationary bicycle to provide the power for the receiver. It's quite interesting that this experiment got started in India and not in the United States. India, simply because nobody has enough money to buy a television set, has only two television transmitter stations. And there's just no market for normal television in India. But by providing community sets through the government, and by doing completely away with any boost stations, but fishing the signal directly out of the sky, 20,000 miles away from a synchronous orbiter, they can now for the first time reach these villages. As I said, the first experiment covered by this treaty will cover 5,000 villages, but India has a little more than 500,000 villages in which about 400 million people live. And if this experiment is successful, the Indians plan already to go from there and make this the mainstay of their educational and communication system for the entire country. So you see how clearly they are bypassing the stage of the wire and the coax cable that go to the satellite direct. Information networking is another interesting thing. Sometimes operations are performed and the doctor needs in a hurry some information available somewhere else. By interrogating medical data banks and so forth, even on real time while he's performing his operation, seems to be a very hot subject for the medical profession. I understand it happens time and again that in the midst of an operation, after a surgeon has opened up a body and patient lies there and anesthesia, the doctor suddenly disappears and goes to a library because he finds something there that he isn't quite sure about how to interpret it, and so suddenly the doctor is gone for 3/4 of an hour, and the nurses have a hard time keeping the patient in this condition, and then finally the doctor comes back with all the answers and continues performing the operation. The doctors, for that reason, particular surgeons, are very greatly interested in ready access, availability of information, and since this information may be scattered all over the world in case of rare diseases, satellites can perform such a ready access system. Well, then there's finally geodesy, tying the continents closer together with unprecedented accuracy. Next slide. Well, here are some charts about Earth resources. Here you see the same area photographed in different regions of the spectrum. Each case, it's the Salton Sea in California, here in the red band, and infrared color, near infrared band, and in the green band. The message here is that by comparing the signature and these various colors, you can read messages out of these photographs that are tremendous. Now, it is not believed that in the long haul, this false color photography will be the way to extract maximum information with Earth resources equipment. The latest thought is that you simply have a kind of a moving mirror that scans as a satellite overflies an area, the overflown area, a little bit like a television beam, and that the light put out from that mirror is continuously put into a spectrograph, and attached to the spectrograph are a number of photometers which simply continuously measure the energy content of the spectrum in say 10 or 20 bands of the spectrum. And this output from these 10 or 20 photometers is then digitized, and a computer can translate the statement. If the energy is distributed in such a way at this particular spot, this must be alfalfa, or it must be wheat, or it must be cotton. These are, in a way, pioneering experiments leading to this ultimate objective. Next slide. Here you see another photograph, the same area taken from a high-altitude aircraft, the various fields showing different color use. If you turn the light off for a second, it will come out a little better. Well, anyway, you can interpret with a number of photographs of this kind what has really grown there in these various areas. Next slide, please. Well, I think this is my last chart, and this just shows you not only what the agency's problem is, but also my own. The agency's budget, NASA's budget, developed between 63 and 66 along this curve here. Then we had our peak here, the highest spending rates of the Apollo program, and we've been coming down steadily now to the present level of 3.3. Now, of course, we in NASA are all very hopeful that this has reached the lowest point now and things will go uphill again. It better go uphill. On the other hand, some of the money that we can expect in the future is already committed to things that we decided to do a little earlier, like flying the remainder of the Apollo fleet to the moon, or building the Skylabs, or flying these Mariners to Mars. So for years to come, a good portion is committed. And what is available really for new starts, such as in the field of logistics, like the shuttle, or in the field of applications and science, like all the other goodies that I mentioned to you here to you is the kind of money that is found in this area. Because if the program if the agency budget rises faster, there will be more money available. If it rises slower, then we can't move that fast. I consider it my main job now to help the administrator determine what we ought to be doing here. And of course, he wants to have several options at his disposal. What do I do if I get this or that? And also, if we take one element out of the program here, what does that do to other elements of the program? So this is the area in which I will have fun. Well, I think this ends my formal presentation. I'll be glad to answer whatever questions you may have. The timetable on the space station and the space shuttle. As I just said here, the realistic timetable will, of course, depend on the funding level that we can expect, but I think there's also a minimum time in which we could have such a reusable system that's simply governed by the time it takes to develop these things. There's undoubtedly some technology work necessary, particularly in the area of structures that can handle this high aerodynamic heating and still be reusable many times. It is our estimate that even if we go full bore and there would be no budget constraints at all, it would probably be something like 1977 before we could have a shuttle flying.
Your introductory remarks, you said that you felt it's one of your jobs to see that missions govern hardware, not the other way around. The next few days, when the Fiscal 71 NASA Authorization Bill comes to the floor of the House, Congressman Koch of New York, member of the House Space Committee, plans to offer an amendment to reduce your funds substantially and to knock out all money, all authorization for NERVA. On the same or apparently same argument you just made, that there's no mission for it, for nuclear rockets. You're stopping production of Saturn V, so you have nothing to put it on top of. Why continue with development? What is your answer?
You mentioned Congressman Koch of New York. The Congressman Koch I know is from Minnesota. Are you talking about him?
K-O-C-H.
Koch.
I'm sorry.
I see. I'm sorry.
K-O-C-H.
It is correct that at the moment there are no hard flight missions committed to use the NERVA engine. This, however, does not mean that we wouldn't want to use it once we have it. We have clearly determined that a nuclear engine like NERVA can greatly reduce orbital transportation cost to synchronous orbit. If your payloads are heavy enough, they can also reduce logistics costs to the lunar surface, and they are also absolutely mandatory if you want to fly heavier and particularly manned planetary expeditions. Now, it is entirely correct that none of these missions is at the moment authorized. On the other hand, the NERVA engine itself will require years and years of basic technological development. And when I said that hardware shouldn't govern the missions, I'm not saying that we should saw off the twig, or the branch on which we sit. You have to lay the groundwork for some of the things now, if you want to have progress in the long haul. I think missions are indeed there and will be there once we have that engine.
When you start flying the shuttles and the boosters, be they both reusable or just one reusable, will you both launch and land at Cape Kennedy, or will it be necessary to make the landings out in, say, Southern California?
If we use discardable launch vehicles and reusable spacecraft only, in other words, the half-reusable concept, then it's obvious that we have to have booster drop areas, and that means we have to go to the ocean. Cape Kennedy is not very suited for launching. It's more northerly than about 45 degrees azimuth, and more southerly than about 110, just because you have safety problems with the booster drop. The Vandenberg facility in California is ideally suited for more polar launches if you launch on a essentially southerly heading from Vandenberg. So for discardable launch systems, launch sites at the ocean, Pacific or Atlantic, will continue to be needed. If you have a completely reusable system, the choice is wide open. There's no reason why you couldn't fly these systems from somewhere the Middle West, because you recover your booster as well as the orbiter. This does not mean that we will necessarily not use, say, Kennedy to fly these things, but it is only one possible contender.
As far as the Grand Tour is concerned, have you worked out the power and the guidance problems already? You'll be climbing uphill all the way as far as the power is concerned. One more question in connection with it. Do you expect any problem from asteroids in the belt between Mars and Jupiter?
To answer the first question first, the energy requirements and the timing requirements for these Grand Tour missions are precisely understood. All these missions have been put to the computer. We can even specify the available windows today. We have not yet locked on a Grand Tour mission, however. For example, I mentioned here two possible missions, both using Jupiter's boost, but one going past Saturn to Neptune and the other past Uranus to Pluto. There are other combinations possible. It is also possible, and we are still studying this, that we may prefer to put a spacecraft into orbit around Jupiter and or Saturn in order to increase the useful science time available for mapping. I think I mentioned in connection with Mars that these flybys have an awfully short scientific utility while close to the planet, and then long periods elapse during which nothing happens. So from the standpoint of science return, it may be more attractive to say, let us do one job right, like going into orbit around Jupiter, rather than visiting all these planets. The other side of the ledger is that Jupiter and Saturn are both very large planets with very powerful gravitational fields, and to orbit a flyby vehicle takes a lot of delta V when you get there, so you have to start with a much bigger rocket to begin with. So I think what it all amounts to is funding. Now, your second question was the asteroid belt. Actually, we know very little about density of micrometeorites in the asteroid belt. We don't know whether there is an increase in micrometeorite density. Chances are that there are, but we have no figures.
How do your plans for a shuttle and space station work out with the military? Can they use exactly what you have, or will they have to modify them or have their own?
Well, we are in continuous touch with the Air Force in this field. Let me make this one point very clear, lest there be some misunderstanding about the purpose of the shuttle and the space station. I understand there have been some articles implying that the real customer of all these things is the Air Force. This is not so. The armed forces, of course, have the duty to look into everything that may have a defense aspect, and so it is entirely proper that they want to understand the ramification of space. Space itself, unlike NASA's charter, is neither peaceful nor military, but is just a place of three dimensions in which you can do all kinds of things, like the ocean or the air. And for that reason, the military would like to study or sit in on our councils to find out what would the capabilities be that these various systems offer. There is no firm commitment on the part of the Air Force to ever build any hardware. They would just like to go along with us, and we in turn are, of course, very eager to learn as much as we can from their technology in order not to duplicate money and waste taxpayers' money. But it is the management of all the studies is in NASA's hands, and there is only a review board on which the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development, Mr. Grant Hansen, sits, along with the NASA administrator, or rather the associate administrator of a manned spaceflight, and they review the progress of the studies as we go on. That goes both for the shuttle and the space station.
What would you assess as your biggest management challenge in your new position?
Well, I would say to come up with the most intelligent proposal for the agency's objectives within the constraints of the available resources.
Dr. von Braun, when do you expect to make this crucial decision on whether the booster should be reusable, and could you please give us some idea of the relative costs of the two alternatives?
Well, I think that decision will be made after all the data have come in, and I think it will probably be later this year before this decision can be made. I will not make it, by the way. It will be made by the administrator after much consultation with many people, including our friends in the Air Force. But I would say later than 1970.
And the cost of the alternative funding that would be necessary for the two alternatives?
Well, I think it, from what we know now, it is obvious that a completely reusable system will cost many times the amount of money to develop. In other words, the non-recurring cost, the development investment, than a maneuverable, reusable spacecraft using discardable booster stages. I would say the cost ratio between the two could easily be a factor of 4 or 5, that the completely reusable system is more expensive. On the other hand, the recurring cost per flight will, of course, be inherently higher for the system using discardable boost stages. So the question is simply, how many flights do you have to make to get your money back? So the traffic pattern studies tie into the decision, which is the most important thing. And that's, of course, to some extent, guesswork. You have to make up your mind whether you want to be optimistic or pessimistic with respect to the budget for the next 10 years, what the traffic will be.
Dr. Von Braun, of course, I'm sure all NASA people are happy that the Department of Transportation is going to keep the Cambridge facility open. How would you look upon and comment on electronic research as needed for the ambitious programs you would like to undertake vis-a-vis JPL, Marshall, Goddard, and any liaisons now with DOT in the Cambridge facility?
Well, let me first say that we are very happy in NASA that the Department of Defense could take over the electronics research facility in Boston. They have Department of Transportation.
You said defense.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Department of Transportation. Let's correct that. We are talking about the Electronic Research Center, Cambridge, Massachusetts.